From the tops of the tallest trees to the ocean's deep, two world-renowned scientists share their stories of the enchanted Earth. This is Florida Matters. Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org. From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Susan Giles Wantuck. We're bringing you highlights of Enchanted Earth, a conversation with two of America's most beloved explorers and conservationists. The event was hosted by the Tampa Theater.
First, I want to thank the sponsors of Enchanted Earth, the Florida Aquarium, Moat Marine Laboratory, University of South Florida College of Marine Science, TECO, University of Tampa, Florida Wildlife Corridor, Ecosphere Restoration Institute, 83 Degrees Media, and MOSI. Dr. Meg Laumann has spent much of her career in the Heights. This Arbornaut opened our eyes to ecosystems that are both vital and mysterious. And she took her two sons along to be part of the discovery. She has solved the challenges of pursuing her scientific discovery by creating ways to access forest canopies. A National Geographic explorer, Laumann has been dubbed Her Highness by eminent American biologist E.O. Wilson. Laumann is based in Sarasota and San Francisco and is the Chief of Science and Sustainability at the California Academy of Sciences. Here in Florida, she has served as climate change advisor to former state CFO Alex Sink. Please join me in welcoming Meg Laumann. Dr. Sylvia Earle has spent thousands of hours underwater and has seen things many of us may never see. She won the TED Prize in 2009 and was a pioneering aquanaut and explorer who also persuaded the founder of Google Earth to finish the task of giving people access to the world's oceans online. Earle is the subject of the new Netflix documentary Mission Blue, which shares her dream of protecting the world's oceans. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Sylvia Earle. Let's talk about the early days, shall we? Sylvia, you talked about Eugenie Clark. What was it about her verve or what she did that kind of infused you with the enthusiasm that got you going on the path?
Well, Jeannie did exactly what you were suggesting, Meg, that she followed her heart. As a kid, her mother took her to the aquarium here in Tampa. You've got a great aquarium. Yeah. The Marine Lab has a great aquarium associated with it. You know, I think of aquaria as halfway houses for people and fish. You know, you kind of meet halfway. And a lot of people, it's the only place that they'll see fish other than with swimming in lemon slices and butter, you know? And you can't really know a fish if you just see their dead bodies, no matter how good they taste. I mean, if you only saw Kentucky Fried Birds, why would you care about birds? Except to eat. Well, we only think of fish, many people do, as something. Well, Jeannie, as a kid, was taken by her mom to the aquarium and got to meet fish, and it just infused in her a desire to really know more and learn more. And the fact that I read a book by Jeannie called Lady with the Spear, and it was published in the 50s, and in it she describes as a young woman, gosh, a solo, one woman in the 1940s, traveling around the world by herself, diving to collect fish, look at fish, get to know fish, meet with people. Just her gumption, her sense of whatever it is you want to do, just go for it, made me think, well, yeah, why not? And, of course, I was an omnivorous reader as a kid, inspired by my mom in particular, my dad too, but especially my mom, who was the bird lady of the neighborhood in New Jersey, and then when we came to Florida, rehabilitating everything that was in the wild that got injured, whether it was a frog or a snowy egret. She took four young snowy egrets that my younger brother rescued from some kids who thought, I guess they were doing the right thing, but they had a gunny sack with these baby egrets, and he asked them what they're going to do with them. I think they didn't know, so he talked them out of them and took them to my mom, and right across the bay over there in Dunedin, she raised them from these featherless little squirmy birds to their full glory, and they flew away one spring, about this time of the year, actually. And here's the thing. They came back and brought their friends. And this little lake that my mom and dad had. And anyway, so between Jeannie and my mom and other role models, a junior high school teacher, Edna Turner, over in Dunedin, was another source of inspiration. They're people, but, you know, Jeannie, as a professional, just kept going. And in my family, my older brother and I were the first two, and then my younger brother, to actually go to college. It just wasn't the thing to do. You could get away with it once upon a time. Now, it's so great that you can actually have access to knowledge and get the credentials, get this distillation of information. The other thing that Jeannie provided, you also champion, it's get out there and get wet. You know, you can read the books, you can listen to lectures, you can do all that, but there's no substitute for being there.
Now, Meg, you seem to have known from your earliest days that you were on your way up to the trees. where did that come from?
I guess in my case, my parents still wonder where it came from. The milkman? I don't know. Just kind of like, really, I was such a misfit. It still amazes me because I didn't get to meet a Eugenie Clark until later in life. I did meet her, and she was amazing. Mm. But in forestry, there didn't seem to be those role models. My role models were all dead. Rachel Carson was someone I admired. And Harriet Tubman, I thought that was in the most amazing biography I ever read in seventh mm-hmm. grade, that she could, in the dark, feel the moss on the trees to take that, you know, people up north through the Underground Railway. I thought, wow, she was the best naturalist I ever heard of. But, of course, she wasn't trained. It was just these awesome stories. So it's really, to this day, I kind of wished I had a female role model, and maybe I have to try to do that better myself for the next generation. I was lucky that Betsy Hilfiger was at least fun-loving to build the tree houses. So that was about the extent of it. My parents were so kind, they didn't know anything about science, but they did stop the road when I wanted to pick a wildflower for mm-hmm. my collection, and they did one amazing thing. I wrote to the president of the Audubon Society, Duryea Morton. Remember we used to use letters and stamps?
Yeah.
And I was 12 years old, and
actually,
I wrote him.
Write a letter.
In New York City, and said, I love nature, but no one in my school or my town does. What can I do? And he actually wrote me back and said, there's a camp in West Virginia that you should go to. And to this day, again, I'm amazed that my mom and dad drove me down in our old Rambler, and we had to cross a stream to get to it. We had to go past a still in West Virginia. And there was this nature camp that was run by an amazingly charismatic middle school teacher that was known in the birding world. And that camp, there were only 20 campers at a time, and I went back and taught there, and my kids went there, and they taught there, but everyone loved nature. So that was for me. 2 weeks a year, I got to be in a place where I was surrounded by people that loved the same thing I did. And that's carried me through a lifetime. All those campers have become heads of the Smithsonian and incredible scientists. So it shows you the power of being outdoors and mm-hmm. maybe sharing it with a few people.
Who love it too.
Well, you know, the trouble with being a trailblazer is there isn't necessarily a path to follow. And with much of what both of you have done, there wasn't a way through. I mean, you had to find that way. Yeah. How did you do that? And how did you know, I mean, was it trial and error? I mean, you had to make all these inventions and things to get through.
Well, it helps to have people who take pity on you. And one of those who did was another mentor, and that's Harold Hum. who's well known in this area. He was in the early days at the University of South Florida, and he got his degree in English from the University of Miami, but then he went on to get his PhD in bacteriology, but loved seaweeds. And I had a chance in the summer of 1953 at the Florida State Marine Laboratory at Alligator Harbor with a group of just 8 students. I was an undergraduate. The others were graduate students. I sort of wiggled my way into that class because, again, I think Harold Hum took pity on me. He saw that I really was interested in the ocean. And so, among other things, that's where I had my first dive.
Cool.
Harold Hum managed to get 2 of the first scuba tanks that came into the United States and used them that summer. There were no instructions other than breathe naturally. So later, you know, with Patty and Nowy and all these other, the Navy divers of the world, I mean, that came about, you know, that's when it all kind of began. But I had the joy of diving for years with no little card.
Good.
But it was Harold Hum, again. And I remember I was so worried. I followed him to Duke University, and he was my major professor. And again, he took pity on me and really made it possible for me to go on that expedition with the 70 guys. He said, you'll be okay. You know,
that's great.
I don't think he wasn't worried about them. He should have been, maybe. Anyway, the idea that I worried about a class in biochemistry that I might not be able to handle it. Yeah, I love chemistry, but that just looked like a little tougher than I was prepared to undertake. And he said, don't worry. If you need biochemistry, you'll figure it out. You'll take a course if you need it. You'll learn it as you go. And there's somehow somebody to just give you the backbone at the right time, somebody who believes in you. And sometimes it's a parent. Sometimes it's a brother or a sister or your mom or dad, but anybody who just says, it's okay, you know, go for it. You'll be all right. Jump in the water. My mother waited until she was 81 before she jumped in the water.
And
then she said, why didn't you get me there sooner? I thought I'd tried, but I didn't try hard enough. So whatever it is, don't wait if you have something that you're just itching to do. Take that leap.
I guess in my case, I call it my misadventures. It took me a long time to process the whole career path and think through, you know, what the hurdles were. But I actually started at Duke, and my advisor eloped with the only other female student at the time.
Oh, that's interesting.
So there I was, bereft of an advisor, bereft of the one female that was in the program, which is now today the Nicholas School, but then it was the forestry school.
Oh, yeah, right.
So after much contemplation, I ended up getting a scholarship and going to Sydney University, and I think I was so naive because I wanted to study the rainforest, and that had it was one of the few English-speaking countries with tropical rainforest, but I'd never seen a rainforest. I just dreamed about it. Right.
Yeah.
And it was sort of this amazing opportunity, I thought. And when I got there, the head of the biology department, well, guess what? Only one female student, and he called me in, and he was so kind, and he looked over his glasses, and he said, I just need to know, why are you doing this? You'll only get married and have children.
I got the same thing, frozen.
I was way too shy to argue back, but it gave me some quiet determination. And I will admit that I climbed trees because I was curious about questions. I wasn't a rock climber as a kid. I wasn't really a daredevil per se. I had my little tree forts, but they were pretty tame. So for me, it was a drive to answer questions about the forest. Having experienced that and realizing that there weren't a lot of role models, maybe that gave me some sense of
trying to become one.
Right, to just keep at it. So that's what happened.
Sylvia, did you have one of those chilling moments? Because I think we've all had one when someone who is a mentor or who is supposed to guide us actually kind of squashes us a little bit, or tries to, you know, maybe not knowing, maybe just out of ignorance or something.
Well, of course, all the time. I mean, but it's not unique to women. It happens to guys, too. You know, you're too tall, you're too short, you're too old, you're too young, you're too fat, you're too thin, you're too this, you're too that. Whatever the reasons are, but if it's something you want to do, figure out how to get over it or under it or through it or whatever it is. How do you get to the tops of trees? I love the way you just figured it out. You just figured it out. I mean, there wasn't a blueprint of these amazing devices right. that you cooked up to to be, you know, a space traveler in the tops of trees. And what, I mean, the thing is, what's, use your imagination. I mean, I'm a botanist, okay? But I wanted to go the other direction. And a number of my mentors I never got to meet, like William Beebe, who wrote just so eloquently about forests, about diving, the half mile down where he and his engineer buddy, Otis Barton, were the first to witness life a half a mile beneath the surface of the ocean. Bioluminescence, these creatures that flash and sparkle and glow with living firefly kind of light. Well, I remember sitting in the little library in Dunedin on the floor just opening, reading these books, and I think I got imprinted at that time with a desire to build submarines. Mm. But as a botanist, I'm not an engineer, so the cool thing to do, you work with engineers.
Right.
you bring them along and share the vision. So I've actually been involved with starting three companies to build submarines and robots and manipulator arms, the manipulator arm that went down with James Cameron to the deepest part of the sea was done by the company, the third company I started that my daughter now owns and operates.
Cool.
Working with engineers. She majored in English.
Oh, right. Anything's possible.
Anything's possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, we still have this vision of building fleets of submarines, like Hertz Renasub or whatever, to be able to go, let any of us go out into the ocean anytime we want. And to be able to explore the world. You can do it with a shovel, looking into the earth, or the bark of a tree, or the top of a tree. The thing is, there's so much we can do now that we...
Speaking of technology, the latest tool for canopy work is drones. We have
drones,
a big...
Yes.
This summer, we're taking an expedition to the Amazon to map the treetops without going there. They will map it for us. So I'm going to become a girl in a hammock, lying there with my gin and tonic.
I don't believe that for a minute.
Ready.
That sounds good, but I can't imagine you just being content with... Oh, just bring me the images.
Exactly.
You know, it's like send me a picture of sitting at a fine dinner and drinking the fine wine. I don't need to drink it. I don't need to eat the dinner. All I need to do is look at the picture, right?
Right. No. We'll see. Yeah. But it is going to be the tool of the future,
I think,
for a lot of our forest work.
We
it's
do.
Exciting. And maybe for undersea, too.
Mm. Absolutely. You can cover a lot of ground, whether it's ground under the ocean or ground in the sky. But... We need all the tools.
Coming up.
We now are beginning to understand not just how much has yet to be seen, but why it matters.
We'll hear more from researchers Dr. Meg Lauman and Dr. Sylvia Earle, along with questions from the audience. And you can see videos of Earle and Lauman at work. Just visit WUSFnews.org. I'm Susan Giles-Wentuck. This is Florida Matters. I'm Susan Giles-Wentuck. This is Florida Matters. We're listening to Dr. Sylvia Earle and Margaret Canopy Meg Lauman as they share tales of their expeditions around the globe and deep into the ocean.
So it seems to me, I mean, when just that Google Earth example, to think that maybe he thought, the founder of Google Earth, that he was done, Do you think that it's still, for so many people, the undiscovered country of our planet?
Well, there's no question that most of the ocean remains unexplored. We've only seen, well, certainly less than 10% of the ocean has been seen, let alone explored. And never mind that you have to, you know, all those mountains down there, you have to start at the tops of the mountains and work your way down. We've seen from the major mountains above water have been climbed many times. Of course, the first time Everest was climbed was in the 1950s, and now there are climbers going up just to bring the trash back down. The many people who have traveled up the slopes have left on the way. Anyway, we now are beginning to understand not just how much has yet to be seen, but why it matters. Why it matters. Mapping the ocean is one thing, and only about the same degree of between 5 and 10% of the ocean has been mapped with the same degree of accuracy that we have for the part above water, or for the moon, or Mars, or Jupiter, or all those other places up there that we have exquisite detail of every square centimeter of the surface. But most of what's under the surface of the ocean, and it isn't just the terrain that matters, but even so, most of that has been discovered, the mountain ranges, the great valleys, the great plains. But the part that is the most undiscovered of all is the ocean itself.
Well, let's open things up for your questions. I'm sure you have some questions.
Hi, I'm April Harley from St. Petersburg. I'm going to try not to embarrass my daughter. She asked me not to stand up, but I'm really happy to have heard from Ms. Lauman on national radio the other day, because my daughter had just told me a couple of days before that she wanted to work for National Geographic and that she was very interested in oceanography, which I know she's very inquisitive. So I'm just practically asking, what are some of the career paths that you see? So for students who pursue a career in, let's say, oceanography or marine biology, who's hiring? You know, what are the opportunities that you see for future?
Right. That's a great question, because I think students always want to think toward the future, which is really important, because I didn't think that way. I wasn't very strategic, so I'm always glad when people think that. There are some amazing careers, I think, in our similar professions. One that really surprises me, and now I'm working at it, is the museum world. They estimate that museums will be doubling in terms of the number of staff hired in the next decade, even, because so many new museums are opening up on a global scale. And then you have science educators, you have scientists, you have exhibit makers. So there's a whole profession relating to the messaging of the kinds of things that both Sylvie and I really are passionate about. So that would be one avenue. There's an amazing number of monitoring and surveying types of jobs opening up for everything from, let's face it, you know, trying to figure out where those Burmese pythons are coming out of the Everglades, to trying to figure out different issues that have to do with invasive species versus native species. A lot of different opportunities in the environmental world, huge opportunities internationally if you like to travel, because countries are really anxious to hire American advisors. In Ethiopia, where I work, they would absolutely be thrilled to have not just Peace Corps people, but USAID, the Gates Foundation. There are all sorts of groups that are now working globally to try to bring best practices about taking care of our planet to all of these countries that might not have had that experience. So it's a great time to consider science as a career.
Hi, I have a question for Dr. Earle. I'm a fourth grade science teacher here, and I've shown my students your film, and they're very inspired. And I think they have a little bit of an idea that, you know, they have to be grown up or do something to make a difference for the oceans or even just their backyard here in the Bay. What would you say to them is a way they could get involved and help the ocean?
Well, I can say for sure that, having been inside the government for a while, that, you know, when you get letters, for example, the personalized letters weigh more heavily than form letters. sometimes postcards and things get counted and weighed, if you will. But letters from kids, an appeal from kids, really touch people in a way that the most rational kind of presentation doesn't achieve. So kid power really rocks, and it does. Yeah. If your fourth graders want to make a difference, identify a project that really, you know, moves them. Is it restoring mangroves to the shores of Tampa Bay? Is it, why not? Yes. Is it protecting a piece of Tampa Bay? Make it an area that you really, where even the fish and the seagrass meadows and everything there, really make it a protected piece of the bay or the coastline. And another thing you could do, or to plant trees. You know, not related to the ocean, but it is. It all ties together. It seems like a stretch, but anything that they can do to keep bad stuff from going into the ocean, or to keep the good stuff from being taken out of the ocean, is a move in the right direction. Maybe it's a project that has to do with just getting people to understand what lives in Tampa Bay, and make it their thing. And what did live in Tampa Bay that's not there anymore? And what do you want the bay to be like in 20 years from now, or even 10 years from now? You can get your arms around 10 years. You know, I was diving in the Florida Keys last weekend. The good news is I saw a Nassau grouper. The bad news is I saw a Nassau grouper. They're disappearing. They taste too good. We need to protect some of these big fish so there can be more fish, so that we can have them going into the middle of the century and beyond. So you should get those kids to write to me, and I'll send them a ton of possibilities. I'm serious.
Thank you so much, Dr. Meg Laumann and Dr. Sylvia Earle.
That's it for today's show. Special thanks to the folks at the Tampa Theater for hosting Enchanted Earth. Our remote engineer is Dustin Hapley. Florida Matters is produced by Lottie Watts and is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Susan Giles-Wentuck. Thanks for listening.